Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back Bob Berman to the studio, and it's always a fun show when Bob is here. Bob is one of the most widely read astronomers in the whole world. His latest book, which is out in paperback now, is called Zoom, How Everything Moves. And if you've listened to Bob before, you know he has a knack for being able to explain very complicated things in very simple ways. And always a fun show. Always fun to try to stump Bob with your mystical, metaphysical questions. I find it a never-ending source of amusement. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now, if you wish, you may email us at voxpop@wamc.org. You could tweet us at WAMC Radio. Just use the hashtag VoxPop. You can go to our website if you want, wamc.org/VoxPop, or even Facebook. It's WAMC Radio on Facebook. There's a VoxPop post there. But the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Hello, Bob Berman. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Ray. Thanks.
How's the book selling in China, old man?
I have no idea. And they
you don't get a cut?
No, but the title is different. They changed it completely. It's something like... never mind. It's different. I'll find out in about half a year.
All right. And then the checks start coming in, and then it's party time over at the Berman House.
Party time.
Yeah, that's great. So you mentioned to me that Venus was back, and darn it all, I had no idea it was gone.
Yeah, we didn't see it last year. And if you were a Venus file, you would have missed it. I missed it, you know, because it's so beautiful. We've all been noticing it.
Why was it gone?
Because it was hiding behind the sun, and the angle of its orbit to the horizon was so slanty, so low, that even when it appeared, it was so low, it was easily hidden. And that was all of last year. So we had a really horrible Venus year. And this year, well, at least for a few months, it's just great. I know everyone's noticed it, even if they don't know what it is. It's the source of more UFO reports than anything else. It's that super dazzling star-like thing for the first few hours after sunset. It actually doesn't even set until almost midnight, but best hours are from 9:30, 10 o'clock.
And how much brighter is it than the next nearest planet in brightness?
By chance, the next nearest planet is in the same direction, that is the west direction of sunset, just higher up, and that's Jupiter. So you have the two brightest objects in the sky, Venus, and then above it, Jupiter. So it's about, let me see, two magnitudes. It would be about six times brighter than Jupiter and something like 40 times brighter than all the stars that are visible, even the brightest of the stars
wow.
these nights. So it's super bright and it's, you know, interesting. And below it lurks Mercury. And there's only about 2 weeks a year that you really easily see Mercury. And that happens to be now.
And that's fairly dim.
It is, but if you have a clear horizon, or some places have malls where they have a clear view toward the sunset, that's what you want, like an unobstructed view to the sunset, where the mountains aren't blocking that part of the sky. Take a look at around, let's say 8:45, 8:50, even 9 o'clock, and there's Venus, you can't miss that, a zillion times brighter than anything else, and look way below it. And directly below it and a little bit to the right of it, and any star you see down there is it. And there's Mercury, even the great Copernicus, the so-called founder of heliocentrism, said he never saw it. Because in Poland, where he lived, the angle of Mercury's orbit was so skimpy to the horizon that it was much harder to see. But anyone can see it. And the fact that the only two planets inside our orbit, the only two planets without moons— that are opposite each other in so many weird, bizarre ways, are both shining these nights. I think it's thrilling.
And we just crashed. Was it on purpose that the messenger crashed into Mercury?
Yeah, because it ran out of fuel. And we actually did a show with one of the messenger prime investigators. And what happened is that it would have kept happily orbiting Mercury for decades, because Mercury has essentially no air to slow it down. But the solar wind is so powerful there, the broken bits of atoms that stream out of the sun, that acts as if it were a real wind and has a braking effect. So Messenger's orbit around Mercury, which was very elliptical. In other words, it had a close point to Mercury, and then it would go far, far away, thousands of miles, and then pass close again. Well, that close point was getting closer and closer with each orbit, and they ran out of fuel to stop it. So they could see a week ahead of time just when would probably be the final orbit. In other words, it was just skimming over the hilltops on Mercury and then managing to go out thousands of miles again and then come in, skimming it even closer, and they knew the end was coming. So it was a mixed feeling, a poignant, sad moment. This was just less than a week ago when we finally lost the only orbiter we ever had.
Now, when was that launched?
It was launched 11 years ago,
Okay. And
then it took 6 years to get there by a circuitous route, and then it's been there orbiting since March of 4 years ago. What is that, 2011?
And was it still sending back data to the end?
Oh, yeah, great, fabulous close-up pictures. It was really useful, and it helped us learn more about that totally weird planet. And when you see the two, they're so opposite. They're so different from each other. Venus is the shiniest planet in the known universe. It's as reflective as snow, thanks to its overcast clouds made of weird stuff, sulfuric acid droplets. And Mercury has the darkest rocks of the solar system. It's as dark as asphalt.
Wow.
So that if some developer, I don't know why anyone would do this, but if some developer went to Mercury and decided to pave the entire planet with asphalt, turn it into a parking lot.
Sure.
It wouldn't look any darker than it does now. Because that's how dull it is. It's dark. Actually, I was going to say black, but it's really a dark, dark orangey brown. And so you have one planet's the most reflective. That's what's out after sunset these nights. And the other one is the darkest. You have one with the greatest pressure would crush a submarine hull. It's 90 times more pressure than we have on Earth.
Venus.
Yeah, Venus, about 40 times more than a pressure cooker, whereas Mercury has no surface pressure. And you have Mercury that has the only planet that has a day that's linked with the sun's gravity so that it orbits around the sun twice while it spins three times.
Ah.
So three spins, three rotations equals two orbits, which means, number one, the sun takes forever to cross the Mercury sky, 176 days. And secondly, we see the same features every other orbit, so that earlier on, observers thought that Mercury had a locked-in rotation that matched its revolution around the sun because they were seeing the same features. They just weren't seeing them consistently.
Oh,
and being human, you know, observers were saying, well, we must be wrong about those. That every other time when they didn't match. And so we thought that its day and its year were both 88 days. It's not. The day is 59 days. The year is 88 days. I know this is more information than anyone
knows. Well, no, it's interesting.
This.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we'll get to the phones in a moment or two. You mentioned that Venus and Mercury are two planets without moons. And I wonder why that is. And if anyone knows, and is it possible that Mercury, which is fairly small, was just a spun-off moon that was once a moon of Venus?
No, probably not. Venus has the roundest orbit in the solar system, and it has a very stable orbit. Mercury has the most elliptical orbit, and just the way the orbital mechanics are, that wouldn't have worked. And also, the relationship of Venus to Mercury in size, about 2-to-1, we would never see that in a moon. The closest we ever saw that was in the poor, demoted ex-planet Pluto.
Oh.
It and Charon had a 2-to-1 ratio, but you know, and now they're not even considered planets. So very unlikely. But here's something weird. As Mercury goes around the sun, the pull of Jupiter, of all things, which is way out there and is nowhere near it, is going to combine with Mercury's orbit to change its eccentricity, how elliptical it is, over the millions and billions of years, so that it actually might go out so far as to collide with Venus.
Wow.
So Venus, which doesn't deserve it because it has a perfectly round orbit, it minds its own business, but Mercury may actually smash into it, destroying them both in the far future.
Why does Venus have a perfectly circular orbit? That's not a common thing, is it?
No, it isn't. Only it and Neptune are the roundest of all orbits. We're not too bad ourselves, and Jupiter and Saturn are somewhat off. The only planet that was worse was Pluto, and as we said,
it's not a planet anymore. Poor Pluto.
It's not a planet. I know everybody seems upset by that. I was actually glad that they did that. I'm going to win no friends by saying that, but as we discovered more and more Plutos out there, and that there was Eris and Quara and Sedna and Maki Maki and all the rest, including
Maki Maki?
Maki Maki.
All right, fine.
Including bodies that were bigger than Pluto. So if Pluto is a planet, then all these other trailer park things.
Trailer park things. All right, Bob, that's fine. We're going to take a break here, and we'll discuss the trailer park planets. Ay, caramba. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back. We'll get to your calls in a moment.
Support for WAMT comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. The Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years. Independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.kendall.org. Planned Parenthood Mid-Hudson Valley, for over 80 years, advocating for policies that will protect women's rights into the future. PPMHV.org for more information. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. And Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road, Colony. Seafood and Raw Bar, accepting reservations for Mother's Day weekend. RealSeafoodCO.com.
Bob Berman's most recent book is Zoom, How Everything Moves. He is a regular guest on Vox Pop, and he's here today. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to John in Canaan, New York. John, thank you for waiting. You are on.
Well, thank you very much. Bob, I want to apologize for this in a way, because about 4 months ago I asked the question I'm going to ask today right at the end of a show, and you didn't really have an opportunity to dig into it, and so I thought I'd call back and pose it again. It's a very large question. I think it's a question that most of your listeners would be fascinated to hear your opinion about, because after all, astronomy and cosmology is your profession, and you spend your life thinking about what it is and what it all means. And that's really basically my question. I'd like to really hear your best guess as to what it is and what it all means, where we're living, and in this very difficult to understand cosmos in which we live. What on earth do you think it is?
Well done. Nice job, John.
Well, that is big, and you have two questions, what it means and what it is, and those are different, because means suggests, say, that there's a purpose, when the actual purpose may simply be existence, enjoyment, being. And is what it all is something being tackled by, has always been tackled by philosophers, metaphysicians, the clergy, of course, and recently, as you've put, cosmology. I'm always hesitant. If you ever hear me, like right now, sounding like I'm hedging, it's because I always feel that the mic in front of me is not for me to promulgate my own, you know, metaphysical or spiritual views, but to really give the science. So let me just say that more and more, I think, although it's still a minority, are seeing a connection between the observer and the universe. Mm-hmm. And by this, obviously, what we see is dependent upon the fact that we have consciousness. For example, the real universe has no color and has no brightness. Mm-hmm. Although we imagine a universe where, you know, there's blues and greens out there and brightnesses, the fact is photons or light are really pulses of magnetism and pulses of electricity. So they're electrical and magnetic pulses. They're invisible. You can't see electricity, you can't see magnetism. So we as observers, create in our minds, in our brains, all the colors and all the brightnesses, and then we use those to learn things about the universe, but we're really part and parcel of the process. And especially with the advent of quantum mechanics, and especially with the Copenhagen interpretation, which shows that, I'm sure you're familiar with the double slit experiment and many others, and EPR correlations and tangled particles, which show that what we observe and whether we're observing, it changes what's being observed. So more and more, it's looking like we're not just little old, poor little me, that sprung into a little part of the universe that the universe doesn't really care about and would get on just as well without us, us meaning life, us being consciousness, but maybe a correlative with consciousness. In other words, you're asking what it is. The universe may be, there may not be any dead universe. The whole universe may be, and our and consciousness may be essentially part and parcel of a single entity. And at minimum, what we observe plays a big role in what we're experiencing. So we'd like to know what this consciousness is. In other words, perception, awareness, the movie screen upon which we see the universe and gain all of our information. Maybe it colors what we see. Maybe these are colored lenses that are biasing us. And if we really want to know what's going on, we have to understand that process of simply being observers. And we're in our infancy in that, just as we're in our infancy of understanding the true extent of the universe. The evidence from 2013 showing that the universe may be infinite, and at minimum, the place where galaxies expand at the speed of light, is the universe is at least 10,000 times larger than what we can see. So we have a very small sample of it. So it certainly produces humility. And what it is beyond that is, let's say, it's more than meets the eye, and it's more than a vast essence that we're inconsequential to.
Wow. John, thanks for the call. The show's over. That was a tremendous question and a tremendous answer. Bob Berman is our guest. No, the show's not over. We haven't done. That was a long answer, though. All right, here's one from Facebook. This is a technical question. This is not metaphysical in any way. It says, hi, Bob. That's you.
That's not technical.
No. I just purchased a Teleview PowerMate 2.5 times for my SkyWatcher 120mm ED telescope. My question is, do I need the Teleview adapter to connect my Fuji XE1 to the scope, or is there cheaper adapter option available?
It's been since 1982 that we've operated a single wonderful, magnificent observatory, and although we've added fantastic professional equipment like 5-inch refractors and giant telescopes to it. It's now over 30 years that I've been using the same equipment, and we have school groups or scout groups coming using it. So exactly what adapters fit with the current equipment is something that I couldn't begin to guess.
Okay.
But, you know, you could call Orion Telescopes, and there's a number of other outfits there. You can find them online, and the people are very happy to help you out and give you the answer to that.
Okay.
But I'm glad you've got a 4-inch telescope. That's a really nice size.
Okay.
You'll have a lot of fun with that.
Ron on Facebook, we appreciate you checking in. Sorry we didn't have anything more specific for you. This one came in via email, and then we'll get back to the phones at 800-348-2551. This one starts, hi, Bob. That's a salutation. Could you try to explain how we can know where we are in the Milky Way or how we can tell where the center of the galaxy is? I can't imagine how we can tell how the galaxy is shaped and where we are if we are looking from the inside. If it's too complex to describe, can you point me to some written material that shows how to figure this out? That's from Rich.
No, it's a great question. And it was only a little more than a century ago that we didn't know that we were not in the center of the galaxy. In fact, for that matter, until the late 1920s, we didn't even know there were more than one galaxy.
Mm.
We thought everything we saw in the night sky was part of a single galaxy, the Milky Way. So, it's a good question. When you only have a worm's eye view, when you're stuck inside this pancake-shaped, glowing object made up of 400 billion dots, stars, how do you determine its true shape? First off, because we're inside this flat pancake, it means that as we look up, we just see a line across the sky because we're inside it, and that's the Milky Way. That's the glow of the Milky Way that completely circles our sky. But where are we located to that? We've found that out through radio telescopes, which show us the glow of hydrogen. Neutral hydrogen glows at a 21-centimeter wavelength, and that gives us a map of where the center of the galaxy is. And the 150 globular cluster, these are very dense clusters of stars with up to a million stars apiece, they're centered in that same spot. So we know that about 27,000 light years from us in the direction of Sagittarius, where indeed the Milky Way is fatter and glows more brightly than anywhere else, that that's the center of the galaxy. Plus we see the direction it's spinning. If you know astronomy a little bit, know the constellations, we're heading toward the star Deneb at 144 miles a second as we go around that center of the galaxy, taking about 225 million years to make the rotation. So we have that pinned down. And all those globular clusters themselves form a ball of clusters centered on that spot, and all the neutral hydrogen forms this spiral pattern centered on that spot. And the motion of the stars in our galaxy show that they're all going around that place. So put it together. We know where we are, and we know where the center of the galaxy lies.
Okay, Rich, thank you for that email question. Back to the phones we go. Bob Berman is our guest. James in Hudson. James, you're on.
Hi. This is a question that I've been thinking about for a long time. If I can put it shortly. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Stephen Hawking said we have about 1,000 years left for the human race.
1,000 years.
1,000 years.
Okay.
And where are we going to go, and how are we going to get there? Because we cannot travel farther than the speed of light, and the stars are far away. And where would we go, and how are we going to get there? That's my question.
All right, fair enough. So first of all, you have to buy the premise, buy the gag that the human race has 1,000 years left.
Right. And
seems a rather arbitrary
That's right,
number.
And nobody knows this. And Stephen Hawking has kept saying things. I mean, as brilliant as he is, he's kept saying things and later retracted them. For example, he used to think that time could flow backward if the universe ever started contracting instead of expanding, that the flow of time would go backwards. And then he changed his mind, as if to demonstrate the process. So he's done this a lot, and nobody knows. No matter how brilliant you are, you don't know that humans have 1,000 years left. We keep getting hit by surprises, and I'm one of those who've seen back from Thomas Malthus that we studied in school, and Alvin Toffler, if you're old enough to remember Future Shock.
I am old 60s. Enough to remember that.
Remember that? And all of these were apocalyptic. Thank you.
Yes,
thank
apocryphal
you.
Is something else.
Right. So, and they turned out to be apocryphal, too, because they weren't true. So we've heard the end of the world stuff over and over again, and we'll see. The human race and the rest of nature is going to unfold as it's going to unfold,
yeah.
And we've been written off before, and we'll see what happens. So he doesn't know we have
so 1,000
years left. Yeah,
plus you'll be dead before
I'm not
that.
I'll be way dead.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
But let's get to the meat of your question.
I'm curious about is how will we get to another planet?
Okay. You know, first of all. I personally don't like the idea of thinking that there are lifeboats out there, because then we might not be as gentle with our own planet Earth as we should be if we think, well, we could always go to Mars and it would only take a few decades of preparation. There really is only one world that remotely offers a shelter for us, and that would be Mars. And Mars is brutal. It doesn't have any air you can breathe. It's got a high radiation flux. And for other reasons, it would be a lot easier to live under the oceans or on top of Mount Everest than it would be to try to live on Mars. So none of these things, even if we could do the technology of sending lifeboats of millions of people to save themselves, this would be a tough nut to try to live on. And that's the only doable planet. So I'd say better to be gentle with our own Earth.
Well, that's good advice, James. Thanks for the call. But as far as saving the human race, not saving everybody, not saving Bob and Ray and everybody else, but saving the human race, and every day, it seems, more exoplanets are being discovered. So putting James's question in a more, in a larger scale, a representative, a Noah's Ark, if you will, when do you think the technology would be there, assuming they can pinpoint planets that are in the Goldilocks zone or whatever you want to call it, where there's a possibility of sustainable life in a solar system? How long would it take us to get technology close enough to the speed of light to get maybe a multi-generational flight out there?
Hmm. I would check choice E, which is never.
Oh, I think you're completely off base, man.
I know, because you're a sci-fi.
No, I'm not.
I've
never
idealistic.
Read sci-fi in my life.
Okay, here's why exoplanets. What you're doing is exoplanets. Now, exoplanets, the nearest possible exoplanet, if we could go 100 times faster than our fastest rockets can go today.
Assuming you'd be able to do that in 500 years.
Okay. Then it would take us about 700 years if we could go 100 times faster than our fastest rockets currently go. But here's the problem. From Earth, our best technology sees these things as little dots. Sure, we can surmise what their temperature might be, but we can't surmise whether they have prohibitive radiation fluxes or other lethal qualities.
Right
to them.
Now. What will we learn in 50 years,
well,
in 100 years,
you can
in
never
200
from Earth,
years?
It's only a pixel. So you can never from Earth with any equipment find out what the radiation is on another planet.
Oh, I'll bet you'd be surprised
so
by it.
So let's say you launch this thing and you send people there on this 1,400 year, provided you could increase our technology. What are the chances that it's actually a comfortable planet? You do much better with our solar system. Because the scale, you can get to Mars in 6 months, and you can get to the nearest planet, again, using today's best speeds, in 40,000 years. So the difference is 6 months versus 40,000 years. So you do a lot better with all that technology that you need and all that time you need to get there to set up a kind of shelter on Mars. At least you've got sunlight. You don't have an atmosphere. You've got oxygen. You've got water that you can extract. You've got the basics that could provide a human-friendly, if buried under the surface, habitat if you really had to. So it's right here in the solar system.
Okay.
You don't head toward exoplanets.
I can't believe it's somebody who looks at the universe and the vastness of the universe wouldn't be able to say, well, 200 years ago, we had no idea that something on four wheels could go 190 miles an hour. And so what will it be like 150 years technology from now as far as learning about these exoplanets that we're just now figuring little things about? And technology, who knows?
To actually go there?
Well, maybe, you know, long after you and I are dead.
Choice E.
Ah, you're a downer, man. Let's go to Joseph in Saratoga Springs. Joseph, you're on.
Yeah, how you doing? So first of all, I love the show.
Nice.
I just had a couple questions. I know you mentioned the effects of the solar wind and Jupiter's gravitational pull on Mercury's elliptical orbit and how it would potentially crash into Venus in the future. I was just wondering, is there any significant effect on other more massive, closer to Jupiter bodies? You know, will Jupiter's gravitational pull affect Venus or Earth or Mars? And will that create any interesting...
No, it's a great question. As you know, I'm sure, because your question is so sophisticated, Jupiter already acts like a kind of vacuum cleaner and deflects asteroids and comets and protects Earth, really, as a shield, because it's 318 times more massive than Earth is. And so things tend to be deflected or attracted to Jupiter, leaving us alone. Orbits that are more circular, such as ours, and particularly Venus, are more... safe, less vulnerable to orbital changes than Mercury's. Also, Mercury goes through its own things because it's of the nearby sun. So it's a sun-Jupiter mathematical problem in physics that can produce a wild change in its orbital eccentricity and extend it, which you don't have with other planets. Now, we do go through cycles ourselves. Our orbit, one of the Milankovitch cycles that produces ice ages here on Earth, one of the factors is the changing shape of our orbit as we go from more circular to more elliptical and back again. So we do that, but not to the extent that Mercury does.
Keep judging. Thank you so much.
Hey, Joseph, thanks a lot for the call. All right, so we have an email question, which I think you'll enjoy, Bob. And I'm going to let you think about what it could be.
I'm going to think of what the question could be?
Yes, I want this to be sort of one of those quantum mechanics. It could be any question, and it's going to depend on what you want it to be. And we'll be back here at 1-800-348-2551. Yeah, it's Astronomy with Bob Berman. Oh, the fun we have.
Support for WAMC comes from Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, announcing open house on May 14th from 1 to 5 p.m., offering a continuum of care and services for seniors, caring in the family tradition, 518-393-8800. Honest Weight Food Co-op in Albany, New York, hosting a public strategic planning event, honestweight.coop/community events for details. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their new website with more information about membership, grants, and loans, so our past has a future, preserveNYS.org. And Autobahn Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of imports, specializing in late model Volkswagen, Audi, and BMW, AutobahnTechnic.com.
Bob, any idea who this is on the guitar?
No.
No?
This is Ask Bob Questions He Can't Possibly Answer.
Yeah, it's T-Bone
answer.
Walker, Bob. Come on.
Oh, okay.
Come
I was going to say that.
I think there was what? There was Galileo, and there was Herschel, and then, T-Bone Walker.
Because you're jazz musician, aren't you?
No, not of any note.
But you do. You play.
Wrong note.
That's why you know this.
All right. So we have an email question.
Let me guess what it is.
It's a subjective universe.
I have a hunch.
All right, so what's the question?
My hunch is that someone has asked, has the gravity controversy been resolved?
Oh, that's very, you know what? It's amazing. Actually, Peter asks via email, has the gravity controversy been resolved? I mean, the time shell, Einstein versus attraction, Newton, at this late date, if not, why not? That's from Peter.
Well, the answer is that gravity is the most mysterious of the four fundamental forces. Nobody still figured out what it was. Newton, of course, thought that any object that weighs anything pulls on other things. Fine, that's great. And he gave the inverse square law, and it worked on apples, and it worked on the moon. He showed why falling apples and the moon do the same thing. Great. And then Einstein said, no, a better way of thinking of it is that it's a warping of space-time. If we imagine, and it was only a mathematical construct. Einstein really didn't think there was like graph paper in 3D out there called space-time. But if you picture an essence of space-time, then any object of mass distorts it so that that object then and other objects near it have to pass through this warped or distorted space-time. And he had the field equations that showed how it would work, and it was more precise than Newton. But all of these were just ways of figuring out how things move. None of them answered what gravity actually is. And even in the recent attempts at string theory and grand unified theories that have all failed, by the way, gravity was the one force that persistently remained mysterious. So the way things, we haven't even found gravitons. I mean, at minimum, we think that each force is carried from one place to another by, like a butler, by a particle. For example, the electromagnetic force that makes our car windows go up and down, magnetism, the electricity we use in everyday life. The electromagnetic force is brought from one place to another by photons, bits of light. But what are the force-carrying particles for gravity?
Wasn't the Higgs boson sort of to help fit into that?
No, that was a different story. That's what gives mass to everything. Now, the gravity, what is the force-carrying particle? We thought it was the graviton, but experiments looking for that have yet to find it. So in all ways, gravity remains mysterious. We have to have some mysteries. It's one of them.
Okay, but you can't really figure out things like dark matter without figuring out gravity, right?
That's right, because they're synonymous. Dark matter is gravity where it shouldn't be.
Right. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Raphael in Shelburne Falls, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
My question's about the cosmic microwave background.
Sure.
And what puzzles me is that I think that my understanding is that we're looking at something that happened in the beginning of the universe when the universe was much smaller. And yet when we point the telescope like 14 billion light years in any direction, we see this thing that, like it's like, I don't know if you understand my question,
but my intuitive
understanding of like spatial awareness is really challenged by this apparent contradiction.
Well, good, because everyone says, but because we're working with models, we really have very little data. You don't hear that on the science shows, that our data is so limited that we replace it with a model-based cosmology, and our model is that this 2.73 degree Kelvin, which we see everywhere, there's very little variation in it. There is some, like one part in 30,000 between one part of the sky and the other, but essentially there's homogeneity to this temperature. These are really microwaves representing this temperature that's everywhere, that it makes sense if about 350,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe became transparent. Before that, it was opaque to electromagnetic radiation, photons. Light couldn't travel. And then as soon as it got transparent, from that moment forward, light could spread everywhere, and did. Now, that light's still around because where would it go? You know, we only have one universe. But as the universe expands, all the photons, and it was blindingly bright at first, get stretched out like taffy or pizza cheese. So the waves get longer and longer and stretched out as the universe expands until what we see now are these very stretched out microwaves corresponding to about 5 degree Fahrenheit or 2.73 degree Kelvin of heat. We would expect to see it everywhere, and we do. And so all this is showing us is that the Big Bang happened everywhere, because no matter how confined we might picture it at the time, a piece of that has become everything that we see. So when people wonder, well, where did the Big Bang happen? It was really Socrates, or wherever you happen to live.
Socrates?
Socrates.
Really? Right
Ray
off the throughway.
Just looked up from the papers that he's scribbling, and
yes.
He said, yes,
Socrates,
on the throughway, exit 20.
Well, I got to go there.
And so that's how it fits in. I hope this explanation helped. Did it help?
Well, so space-time has expanded, so what used to be the center is now the outside of the universe?
No. Everything is still the center. Everything is still where the Big Bang happened, because just because it becomes bigger and bigger, that doesn't leave behind a location where it once was, you see, because every here, H-E-R-E, that was the case there, is still the here. So where the Big Bang occurred, we all have a piece of that Big Bang. And we all have a piece of the light that was there. The only thing that's changed is because the universe has expanded, the light has stretched out and become dimmer and redder, until now it's merely microwaves that are equally everywhere.
Okay. Raphael, thanks a lot. So everywhere's here?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we've reached that lava lamp, light the incense moment.
That's right. You
it only
here.
Took
that's
47 right. minutes into the show. Really good. Let's go over to Steve in Hurleyville. Steve, you're on.
Hi. I met somebody who's working on the Webber telescope.
Okay.
And he told me, I forgot a word that he gave me, so I look it up myself. He said that the telescope's going to be about 1 million miles away in a certain location.
L5, yes.
But he's going to be neutralized or something like that. I'm not sure. I was wondering if you knew about what that was.
Yeah. The James Webb Space Telescope is making a lot of us uncomfortable, because unlike Hubble, which, as you know, needed repairs here and there, things broke down, especially the gyros.
and the lens originally was wrong.
Originally, the main 94-inch mirror had to be repaired. But fortunately, the Hubble Space Telescope was placed in orbit around Earth, where it could be and was accessible to repairs that extended its life. The James Webb Space Telescope is being placed on the far side of the moon in a gravitational position where it kind of can hover, where the moon is going to block Earth light and where it's going to be shielded from Earth interferences, and all of that's very nice, except that you can't possibly go there with a wrench and fix it. So if they asked me, which of course they didn't, man, I'd put this back in orbit, and okay, so you've got Earth light interfering a little bit, and because it's an infrared telescope, unlike Hubble, which was mostly visual,
yeah,
the James Webb telescope will be mostly infrared. It's not even going to look at visual
wavelengths. So you need cold. You need to be far away from...
Yeah, and that's going to protect it. But the caller is absolutely right. Located where it's going to be located, it's, you know, goodbye, and let's hope everything works perfectly, because there's no going there and fixing it ever.
But what's the upside if everything works perfectly?
You mean
it's a big upside, right?
Yeah, that's an upside, and if it works perfectly. But tell me a mission where everything worked perfectly.
Well, this program. I mean, obviously.
Okay.
Right? When Bob Berman is the guest. Thanks, Steve. Let's go to Pete in Albany. Pete, you're on.
Good afternoon, guys. I was in New York City in the mid-90s, and I remember there was a solar eclipse, and all the slits between the leaves and the trees cast a shadow of the eclipse in various sizes, big eclipses, small eclipses, just this incredible thing that happened in New York City in the mid-90s. It's not really a question, it's just relaying that fact.
Yeah, it was very cool. That was on May 10th, 1994.
I remember that one.
And anytime you get the sun significantly blocked so that it's no longer a circle, every little space between leaves acts like a pinhole camera.
Exactly.
This was Al Hazen's idea back in the year 1000 AD, where he used to make pinhole cameras in his tent, and his fellow Arabs would come in, and they all loved it because they could see pictures of the world portrayed upside down as if you had a lens back in the pre-lens days. But yeah, and so you scrunch up your finger, make little holes in it, or you look between leaves, and you see a lot of sun images. Instead of the little round shapes that you see between leaves, shadows on the ground, now they're all crescents. But listen, don't fall for it when we have our first total solar eclipse, which is coming up on August 21st, 2017. The first one in 38 years.
All right.
The path of totality will sweep across the entire country, but a lot of people will think, hey, where I'm living, it's going to be a 90% eclipse. That's good enough. Please travel, drive, wherever you have to go to get to totality, rather than settling for the partial eclipse. Even though the partial will show those pretty things like those crescent suns and the leaves, make sure you plan to go and see the total eclipse, because it's life-changing.
Okay. And Socrates, it'll be the center of the whole thing, obviously? No, where will we be able to see it in its totality?
Oh, it'll be a little 140-mile wide ribbon that starts in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, sweeps over the Grand Tetons, and then we'll pass over Wyoming and Casper and southern Illinois, and then over parts of Tennessee, and then finally the Carolinas. Oh. But I would not recommend the Carolinas, because it'll be the afternoon and steamy and more likely to be cloudy. I think you should go to eastern Idaho or Wyoming, yeah, or one of those states.
Grand Tetons
there
are lovely, so that's a good spot. Yeah. All right, let's go to Erica in Latham. Erica.
Hi, hopefully I have an easier one for you. I am curious, your suggestion for the best sky viewing, the best stargazing in the capital region, with the least amount of light pollution and the most amount of sky?
Well, when you look at the dark sky maps, the darkest, most beautiful skies you can get are in the Adirondacks. And the Adirondacks, of course, the problem there is there's lots of trees and hills,
yeah,
mountains.
Right.
So finding the combination of open skies plus being away from the city, that's always a little tough one. Most areas, once you get out into the rural areas, the locals know where to go. Often cemeteries are good, because they're usually rural and outside of little villages, and they're open, and many of them, they'll allow you to go in there. Lakesides, and Albany specifically, because it's a big city, you know, you've probably got to drive for about 45 minutes. I would think the Alcove Reservoir would be a little bit too still light polluted towards the north and east from there. So I couldn't recommend a particular a field or place from here. I know I'm just thinking frantically. You know, where I live down in the Catskills, I know the places that I like to go. Just make sure you're at least half an hour from Albany-ish. And
okay.
you know, find it in an open place. If you ask around, police departments are usually really good with this, and you could just call around a rural. Right. No, seriously, call around a rural police department, ask them for their rules about cemeteries and things like that, and you can find it.
Okay, Erica,
that's
thanks a lot.
That's a creepy phone call to make. All right, thanks so much.
It is a creepy phone call to make. That's a good point. Lisa in Albany. Lisa, you're on.
Hi, yes. I'm calling regarding a call that came in a couple of calls ago about the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm asking for clarification because I think and Bob Berman has gone into this before, but I think I've understood from his explanation, it isn't that objects in the universe are traveling like cars on a road away from a point. It is that the road itself is expanding. Even if you're still on the road, you're moving farther away from something because the road itself is expanding, space itself is expanding. And that's part of the explanation of why there is no point to look back to and why we're all part of the Big Bang.
It's beautiful what you said, and it's absolutely right. I couldn't have done better myself with that. And it sounds impossible because when we think of space as nothingness or emptiness, how can emptiness do anything? But nonetheless, the emptiness of space, as it turns out, space doesn't really exist because there's lots of stuff in there. It's composed of vacuum energy or zero-point energy fields, neutrinos, photons. There really is no such thing as nothingness that's expanding. But whatever this matrix is of the universe between objects, yes, that's what's getting bigger, and so objects are just being carried along like floating leaves in a stream. And it has to be the case because when you look far away, you get objects that are increasing their speeds, approaching the speed of light. And no object that weighs anything could possibly do that, according to Einstein. So it's not that objects are accelerating, that there's something that's pushing them faster and faster. It's just exactly as you said it, that the empty space between the object and the next object over is expanding. Oddly enough, we don't see this in our own neighborhood. Like, our solar system, of course, is not expanding. Our galaxy is not expanding, which means every star you see in the night sky, nothing's going away from us. We're gravitationally bound. And even our local group of galaxies, 30 galaxies, are not expanding, because we're held together gravitationally. So when we talk about the space expanding, we're talking about a very, very large scale phenomenon where the space between clusters of galaxies are increasing their distance from other clusters of galaxies. But within each cluster of galaxies, there's no trace of the expanding universe.
How do you know you're right?
Well, we can see the Doppler shift. We see objects that are not going away. In fact, in this case, Andromeda is coming toward us at 70 miles per second. That will probably even collide in about 4 billion years. So not only is it not expanding away, it's actually on a collision course coming toward us.
And of great comfort, Socrates will continue to be the same distance from Albany
for
a while.
Exactly. Lisa, you have it. You have the zen of the whole thing. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
All right, Bob, what's coming up? We have about 30 seconds. Anything, any big activities up in the sky we should be looking for in the next 30 days until you're back?
Well, it's Venus, of course, and Mercury just for the next couple of nights. We'll have clear weather. Look for the single star below and a little bit to the right, way below Venus, and you'll be one of the rare few people, relatively speaking, to see Mercury. Venus is just going to get brighter between now and the next time I'm here. Jupiter is that bright star above Venus. This is not a time of meteor showers.
Okay.
We do have one coming up, but it's a skimpy one. So
kind of a low rent.
Yeah,
I get you. To make fun of the cosmos some more, Bob. So the book is Zoom, How Everything Moves. If you're in China, pick up a copy. Or if you're in Socrates, you can get one there. Always great to have Bob Berman on the show. And I thank you all for listening and for calling in today. Support comes from Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Supporting the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy, interimhealthcare.com. The Whistling Kettle, tea shops and cafes in Ballston Spa and downtown Troy, New York, serving Mother's Day tea. TheWhistlingKettle.com for reservations and gift ideas. Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts, conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture and chiropractic therapy, comprehensive pet care and health services since 1998, WindyHollowVet.com. And Valley Home Improvement, designing and building kitchens, bathrooms, interiors, and additions throughout the Pioneer Valley. Love your home. valleyhomeimprovement.com. Thanks again to the great Bob Berman. Thanks to Zach Malloy for answering the phones. No, he was at the controls. Deb Malik answered the phones. And Jessica Blaustein Marshall is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Don't forget the lockbox. We shorten the drive. Every dollar you pledge at WAMC.org will shorten our on-air fund drive, which begins in early June. WAMC.org. Tomorrow at this time, it's a Food Friday. Stay tuned now for a news update.